Hi, Mom.
Hi, Ben. How are you today?
I'm good. We're going to do something a little bit different today.
Goody, goody. You know, I like change and new events.
Well, we've to this date in our first 13 episodes of this podcast, we've done what I'm, for lack of a better word, calling epochal episodes, which is to say, each episode has focused on a specific period of time in your or our lives. And today we're going to do a hopefully fun sidetrack episode in which we're going to talk about the topic of where were you on ... And I have a list of national or global events which have occurred between 1961 and 2005 on my list. We may come up with some other ones as we go. And there may be some of these which there's no interesting story for. So we'll see what happens and hopefully we'll have some fun.
Awesome. Let's get going.
All right. So my first event was on April 17th, 1961. It was a Monday. And you were 17 years old, and it is the Bay of Pigs offensive.
Correct. Where was I? I was in Anchorage, Alaska.
And was it an event that had immediate impact on y'all, or was it a slow roll news story? Or do you remember how you, like, was it a, you know, I guess the classic event in this list for this kind of thing is 9/11, where it was a real bolt from the blue.
Yeah.
I know that with the Bay of Pigs, there had been a couple of weeks of news stories leading up to it, I believe.
That's correct. It was, I would say it was a simmering burn. It started off as a news event, but I will tell you that because Granddad was head of operations at Elmendorf Air Force Base, that it was a big event for him because it involved the Russians. And it was Alaska, as you know, is 43 miles from Russia. And so it was a big event up there, and we really locked down at West Anchorage High School and all of the schools at, you know, getting under a bell, a siren going off in the school one or two or sometimes three times a day, and us, you know, crawling under our desks and preparing for a nuclear event. So,
okay. So, and that was, those were drills in anticipation of something happening?
Correct.
Okay. And then was there, like, when the offensive happened and the failed attack went down, was there any, like, was there a lockdown when that occurred, or do you remember anything surrounding, or like the actual, the wake of the event or the,
it was, well, yeah, because Granddad was in the military and he was right in the middle of it. It was a nervous time, you know, in our house, in the community of Anchorage, in the because two gigantic military bases are up there, Richardson Air Force Base, well, three actually, Elmendorf in Anchorage, and then Fairbanks, Eielson Air Force Base. So huge military presence. And since it was a military affair, yeah, it was a nervous and kind of mind-boggling time that none of us had ever experienced. You know, I was born just as World War II was ending, so I had never really had any experience with wartime. And so we had always had the perfect, charming American life.
Yeah.
And it was disturbing. So,
and would you consider this event one of the first things like that in your life?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because the Korean War, you know, would be...
I don't remember much about that because I was like in kindergarten and, you know, I was young. I do remember we were living in Falls Church at the time of the Korean War, and Granddad was stationed at the Pentagon. And after dinner every night, we would sit down around the radio console, no TVs back then, and listen to the news, I think, with Walter Cronkite and then the president would give a speech, like it seemed like every week on the radio. you know, like the fireside chats when Roosevelt was in office, something like that.
Right on. Well, that's a nice segue into my next question on the Bay of Pigs, which was, how were you receiving news about it? It's interesting that Granddad was, in a way, I know he wasn't on the inside in terms of the inside of the operation, but he was more on the inside being in the military than your average person. Were you all receiving news through Granddad's conduits as well as through the radio, or was it like just all through the radio and the newspaper?
It was primarily through the newspaper, the radio, and the television. We did.
Oh, that's right. By then,
a small black and white television when we were in Alaska. But, you know, most of the stuff was top secret. And so Granddad was not allowed to let us know what was going on. But we knew the amount of time that he was spending in the operations center that something was going on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I wish I could hear his stories about that. So, okay. Well, I think that's probably enough on the Bay of Pigs, unless anything else comes up on it as we're moving forward here. And I will take this minute or moment to mention that, you know, unfortunately, most of these are negative events. I've tried to sprinkle in a few good things, but
they're the ones that make history, right?
When it comes to that kind of shock of knowing where you were the moment something happened or whatever. And the Bay of Pigs may have been a bad one to start on, since it was kind of a simmering role thing. But this next one, I think this next one is everyone from your generation has an answer to where were you on.
Wait a second. Let me interject one more thing about the Bay of Pigs. There is a fantastic movie about the Bay of Pigs, and I cannot remember the name of it. But you should look at it sometime.
Well, I'll look that up and we'll follow up on it when we do our next episode. Speaking of which, at the beginning of this episode, I forgot to do any follow-up from episode 13 on y'all's time in San Francisco, but I don't think I personally had anything. And if you have anything, I'm going to make a note to cover it next time.
Yeah, I don't think I did either. I think we pretty much covered it.
Awesome. You may already have guessed what I'm going to ask next, but where were you?
Let me guess. JFK.
JFK assassination, yeah. That is. Friday, November 22nd, 1963, you were 19 years old, and?
As you said, the big historic events, you know exactly where you were. I was walking home. I was at the University of Missouri in Columbia, Missouri. I had walked back from my chemistry lab, and I had just walked into the cafeteria at Jones Hall and was getting ready to have some lunch, and it was coming over the loudspeaker, the PA system. And it was just as best I recall, it was right before lunch. So and everybody just sort of sat there in disbelief and shock. So, and then at some point, there was not a TV in that space, but at some point, I think in the reception area of the dorm, you know, where you came in and got permission to go see somebody or whatever, there was a small television and there were, you know, tons of people. The room was standing room only with students crammed around trying to see what had happened. So.
Mm-hmm. And was Dad with you, or what was he doing?
He was in class, or, you know, no, he was not with me. So.
Do you remember your first experience of it with him, like when you saw him afterwards?
We just spoke about how unbelievable it was for something like that to happen in the United States. And, you know, your dad was a history major and super interested in all of that stuff. So I don't remember exactly what he said, but I know it was upsetting, and he was well aware that it was historical.
And I know that it was a lot less of a partisan time back then. But yeah, I presume you were both fans of JFK.
We were. Yeah. That was my first voting experience. I was in Alaska. Yeah, I guess it was 1962, right? Or 61 was the vote. November of 61, probably.
Probably. Yeah.
Yeah. You could vote. Well, I was 18, I guess. Yes, that was my first voting experience for the president of the United States.
And you voted for JFK?
I did.
All right. And then, I had another question and it just left my mind about that. The other thing was, didn't you all go to JFK's inauguration?
We did, when we lived in McLean, Virginia.
Yeah. I've got the ticket stubs from that here at the house.
Yeah. It was in 1961. A huge blizzard happened the night before the inauguration. We could barely get down into Washington. Granddad had reserved parking because he was working at the Pentagon in some, I'm not sure what he was doing, but anyway, he had reserved parking and seating. So we managed to make our way to the seats. It was me and Granddad and Richard and Ben. Grandma decided to stay at home and cook so we would be warm and well fed when we got home. And I might add, she was the smart one. And the reason we probably wouldn't have gone because of the blizzard, except that Sambo was there and he was marching in the with the Air Force Academy, and he was not the commandant, but I can't think of what you call the student that's the head of the student body, you know,
it's called a big man on campus.
Yeah, that's what he was. And so we wanted to see him march, of course. So, and we did.
Very cool.
And it was freezing by the time we got home.
I remember how cold it gets in DC. Wet, nasty, cold.
Yep. Cold and wet.
All right. Well, moving right along, this next event, you were also 19 years old, but this was on Sunday, February 9th, 1964, that famous evening when the Beatles appeared on Ed Sullivan.
I do remember that. And 1964, I guess we were in still in Washington, I think. 1964.
No, you would have been. That was if you were in.
No, your dad and I got married in August of 64. When was it?
February of 64.
Okay, so we were in Alaska still. Mm-hmm. No, I was at the University of Missouri is where we were. Yeah, we saw it. But, you know, when you're in college, an event on TV is not near as big as the college experience you're having.
That makes sense to me, too. And you're less of a, I mean, even though, I don't know, I can see it being less of an event than being younger.
Well, I'll tell you who it was a big event to, and that was Granddad, because he could not deal with those long hair, what he thought were long haircuts at the time. he thought they were wild, crazy kids with hoodlums with too much hair, whatever.
Which was pretty much the popular opinion of anybody over about 25 at that time, right? Like
exactly. So when Ben and Richard both grew their hair like the Beatles, it was almost more than Granddad could deal with.
Uh-huh.
Being a military man and a buzz cut man, you can appreciate that.
Were you in the dorm with your lady friends, or were you with Dad, or do you remember who you were watching with?
You know, I don't. I think we were watching it again in the reception area of the dorm because it was the only TV around, and it was not a big deal. You know, I mean,
okay, yeah. In the moment, it didn't seem like what it's come to be.
Well, we didn't have social media back then, so to us, it was just like, oh wow, this band that's such a big deal in England is coming over here. They're going to be on Ed Sullivan. Woohoo. Let's go have a beer instead. You know, I mean, it was.
Had you heard their music before
Yeah. We had heard it on the radio.
Okay. That makes sense.
And you've got to remember too, that was before ear pods.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah.
All of the hand carrying music stuff.
Well before
transistor radios, but they were huge, you know. Uh-huh. It's not something you'd stick in your ear and listen to while you were taking a walk to class.
And it's well, and in talking about it with you, I'm reminded that it was more of a visual experience because everybody had heard them already, but it was the seeing them on TV that was such a big deal.
The wildness, you know.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Which is funny because they seem so tame now.
They do. Well, I'll tell you know what it reminds me of. It reminds me of how freaked out everybody was when they saw Elvis do his hip gyrations. And when, what was that crazy guy who played the piano during
Jerry
the
Lee Lewis.
Jerry Lee Lewis. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense.
It was change, you know. Yeah.
I wish I had those dates, but I don't have them in front of me. So I don't know if that was before or after this 1964. I'm going to say before, probably the Elvis stuff.
I'm going to, I'm going to say definitely before, because, you know, a lot of women about my age just, you know, still to this day are just like,
true. That's, yeah, that's
fainting about Elvis. And I'm like, I could care less about Elvis. So it was before that. Yeah.
You were more of a Jerry Lee girl.
Yes, I was actually.
All right. Well, so next up I have, and I have a feeling this one is going to be similar to the Bay of Pigs answer, since it was sort of a simmering thing also. But you were 23 in January 30th, 1968, the Tet Offensive. And this is the first of a couple of Vietnam things that I have. And the Tet Offensive, in my understanding, was the beginning of the violence with us involved. Is that right? Or
not really. You know, your dad's first tour in Vietnam was in 1966 and 67. It was.
Oh, that's
when
right.
So there were several Tet offenses, and that was a big one. And was it that big a deal to me? No, I was interested because your dad had been to Vietnam and I knew that he was going again. And I would say, and this is probably ignorance and I don't think it's right, I would say it didn't involve me because it was more on the ground than it was in the air, but I'm sure there was just as much air support as, you know, as ever. I just didn't think of it as such because all the news coverage primarily showed the ground, and there were so many soldiers on both sides killed during those Tet offensives. But I will say that when your dad when the entire wing left from Holloman to go, it was for the last Tet Offensive, which was in 71, I guess, 72, maybe, right before the end of the war.
Okay. I guess, even though I watched that, you know, 20-hour-long Ken Burns thing on Vietnam that taught me a lot more than I ever knew about it, I get so confused about it because the Tet is the holiday over there, and the big deal was
it is.
They expected them not to do anything on a holiday, and then
exactly.
They did or something.
Yep.
Or it was kind of a Kristallnacht for Vietnam in the sense that they were taking each other out. And I don't know. I'm talking
that's exactly right.
Okay.
And the Americans didn't expect it either. So,
yeah. Okay. Well, that's, I think we're going to gloss over that one and move on then. But although you gave me a good answer there, I'm not diminishing your answer. I just, as the war was a quagmire, so are our memories of it.
Well, and you know what, it went 20, yeah, it was 20 years long. So,
yeah. Yeah. So, the Tet Offensive that I marked here was the 1968, which begins the 1968, pretty treacherous year for a lot of reasons. I'm not going to go into all of the dates of interest, but I've got two more, probably the obvious ones. On April 4th, 1968, Thursday, you were 24, and Martin Luther King was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee.
Correct.
And was that something that resounded in your circle?
It did. And again, we only saw it on television, right? Of course, it resounded in my circle, being raised not in the South, but in the Southern family, and realizing all the implications and the tragedy and everything that went on with racial injustice in the South. So, yeah. And he was and still is a big deal, you know?
Yeah, of course. And you would have been in Hamilton when that happened, or do you, 1968?
Yes, yeah. Yep, yeah, Hamilton. Let me interject one thing about the last question, which was about the Tet Offensive. Remember, we were in Alaska. So the Bay of Pigs happened in Alaska when we were in Alaska. And then the next thing was that the shot that was fired that basically started the Vietnam War on, I can't think of the name of that water, not an ocean, but, you know, like that area over there where that boat was shot at, and that was what started our involvement.
Vaguely know what you're talking about.
We were sitting at the kitchen table in Alaska, you know, and Dad got a phone call, and he shot up and ran out and you know, was on his way to the operations center. So,
Wow. That's interesting to think of granddad being tied up in Vietnam. I don't ever think about that, but that's it. Of course he was, I mean, to some degree there. Yeah. Because when did he retire? And
he retired in El Paso. So I can't remember the year. When did they move to El Paso? It was like 60. I mean, we were in Hamilton.
I thought it was like 74 or 5 when he retired. Was it that
late?
No,
because they moved back to Fairhope in 70. So it was probably like 67, 8, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
66, I bet.
Okay. That's it. So he overlapped the Vietnam War, but just barely, and in the ending years of his time there. It was just starting up when he was retiring, basically.
Exactly.
All right. So MLK assassination, interestingly, just from a date nerd perspective, the MLK assassination was on 4/4, which was a Thursday. And then later in the same year, on another Thursday, which happened to be 6/6, Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated.
In Los Angeles, yes, he was.
Of the three, this is the one I know least about, but I know it was also... on one hand, obviously, it was a big, huge deal. I think he was going to be running for president and some other things, but it was also
the
third major political assassination in 5 years in America, in a time it's so weird to think about political assassinations being semi-normal like that. Is that something tell me what about RFK and about...
It was terrifying every time. You know, I mean... Of course, it started with JFK. All of America was just, this can't be happening here, you know? And then it happened again with Martin Luther King, who everybody thought was going to be the savior of the Black man and the, you know, the turning around of the horrible injustices against race. And yeah, just craziness. And then... It was like the topping on the cake, not in a good way. RFK was in Los Angeles in a hotel, you know, doing a, he had decided to run for president, and he was there, just there giving us, it was more like a rally, you know, he was giving a speech. And yeah, that guy came out from the, Sirhan came out from the kitchen and just shot him in the crowd. So I think he had finished his speech and he was talking to, you know, out there glad handing, you know,
Yeah, that's one. You see the video of that one occasionally, and it's quite alarming.
Yeah.
You were in Hamilton still with Dad, same year as the MLK thing.
Yeah.
All right. So this next one we have talked about, I'm pretty sure, before on this podcast, but we're going to talk about it again because it's one of the few happy ones.
That would be your birth in 1970.
No, I didn't really quite consider that a national or global event, although some might consider it that way. You know, you never know. But no, this was on July 20th, 1969. You were still, or no, you would have been 21 then, or 20, oh, hold on, 25 then. Yeah. And this is the moon landing.
Oh, I know exactly where I was. Yeah, we did talk about it before. I was standing going between the kitchen and the living room in Hamilton Air Force Base with the television on, and I had been watching that thing with bated breath. Your dad happened to be on alert that weekend or whatever day it was in Oregon, and he called me as they were coming down to land. He was like, Have you got the TV on? Turn it on so we can watch it together. And I did. I said, of course I have it on. And so we watched it and the moon landing and then putting up the American flag, and we both started crying over the phone. It was pretty dang emotional. Yeah.
That's
awesome. It was awesome. Yeah.
That's great. So since we've been over that one previously, even though it's so delightful, I'm going to just move on. On this next one is, this is a curious one, but I'll be interested to hear your, there's a couple on here that are just a little bit odd, but this one is Friday, April 10th, 1970. You were 26. And it's actually a side note. There's a disproportionate number of these happen in April for some reason. But
that is kind of weird, isn't it?
Yeah. So this one is the Beatles breakup.
I do remember that. I don't remember where I was, but it was a big deal. Uh-huh. You know, when it was in April of 70.
Yeah.
So I was, we were still at Hamilton Air Force Base, and there was a lot of, San Francisco was a big place for up and coming music. So, you know, music was a big deal, and of course on both coasts. So yeah, it was not a huge event in my life, but we were very surprised.
Did it feel like the end of an era at all? Or was it, did it not feel like that in the moment? Yeah.
Okay. No.
All right.
You know what? There were so many good bands at that time in 1970.
Yeah.
Yeah. Music was great back then. Good listening.
Awesome. All right. So a month later, on May 4th, 1970, you were still 26. Still, I presume, in, well, you actually might have been in.
No, we were at Hamilton. No, we went to San Antonio in July.
July. Okay. So this was the end of your time in Hamilton, and this was the Kent State shootings.
Oh, yeah. It was pretty disturbing, actually. At that time, the country was so divided about support or non-support of the Vietnam War. And it was especially, of course, with most uprisings, real, real volatile on college campuses. Because those were the kids. There was still a draft back then, so those were the kids getting drafted and going to Vietnam and dying. So it had it was a particularly emotional and passionate feelings about that among you know, draft age kids.
Uh-huh. And it was, and your position in it is interesting to me, being with Dad in the military, when I think Kent State was something that really shocked the nation into its opposition of the war. It kind of brought the opposition to a head, would you say?
Yeah, it opened people's eyes who had their heads buried in the sand.
And how did it resound in like the military, in the squadron and stuff like that? Was it like, I know they weren't pro-war, but you know what I'm saying? Like, were the Kent State kids seen as being the problem, or the state troopers or whoever, or the National Guard who were shooting, or was there an opinion that was held widely, or did everybody think of it? Were people smart enough to hold their own opinions, or you know what I'm saying? Like,
Most people were smart enough to hold their own opinions, but most people, as I recall, thought that, the troopers had overreacted. And I think you're seeing that now too, with the Black Lives Matter. You know, it was kind of like that. It was like, why did you shoot that person? You know,
okay, that's a really interesting comparison, because one of the things that brought the Black Lives Matter thing around was all this stuff being on video now. And that was all caught on video back then. It's amazing. Yep. That's super interesting. I never thought about that. I've got chills. Thank you for connecting those dots.
Well, and you're right, that it was all on film, and that was pretty disturbing to see. You know, to hear about it is one thing, to see it is another.
Absolutely. Yes. That's
yeah.
Wow. All right. So moving right along. So these next three are kind of a group. So I'm just going to list them, or I'm going to put them out there together. And this is another thing that was sort of a marker of the end of the 60s, the way the Beatles breaking up and Kent State shootings are thought of. And this is the overdose deaths of Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, and Jim Morrison, which happened basically within the same year, starting with Jimi Hendrix in September 18, 1970, then Janis Joplin, October 4th, 1970, then Jim Morrison, July 3rd, 1971. So all this happening right around, or actually in the immediate aftermath of my birth, I'm pretty sure I bear no responsibility, but do you remember those events, and did they seem connected, and like as a sort of a, the way that the political assassinations had been a thing, did kind of rock star overdoses suddenly become a thing? Or, and I'll just let you take it.
Okay. Well, it did become a thing. And I think what really became a thing was not rock star overdoses, because I didn't even connect the two at the time, but was the start of the drug culture.
Okay.
Which I look back now and realize, I mean, you know, 1969, and I was there, was the summer of love in San Francisco, Haight-Ashbury, psychedelic drugs, all sorts of drugs, you know. And of course, those performers had easy access, and if they had to pay for them, could afford it. And it was just, it was part of the culture back then, that the beginning of the culture, I should say, I think.
Yeah.
We just weren't aware of it at that point. You know, I've always said I was right on the cusp. My two older brothers drank alcohol, and then there was me in the middle, and my two younger brothers were brought up during the drug culture. And there's a definite difference. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm kind of on the cusp.
Uh-huh. And that's an interesting point. And of course these three are interesting because they happen so close together and are kind of at the front end of it. But of course there was, you know, dozens, if not hundreds of others affected by it over the years. But yeah, that's it. And these, I think three kind of pointed to the dangers in a way that people didn't necessarily know about. I mean, people used to think that cocaine was good for you and cigarettes were good for you.
Yeah.
And we had to learn that they weren't.
Exactly. And I agree. It was kind of the beginning. It looked like fun and exciting, and that's what kids that age like.
Yeah. All right. So the next one is a couple years later, in August 9th, 1974. You were 30 years old. I was 4 years old when Richard Nixon,
I know what this is,
announced his resignation.
Yeah. Sorry. I know that one well. Mm-hmm. I had to interrupt you and tell you, I know what you're going to say. I had just come back from Thailand. And was in the midst of passing a kidney stone, lying on grandmom and granddad's bed and watching their TV. And I watched the whole thing. I watched the hearings. I watched everything. I watched his resignation. I remember it well.
So that alone is worth this whole episode. That's the kind of story I've been hoping for. I knew about Nixon resigning. I knew about your kidney stone. I did not know that those events were tied. And it's so rare for you to watch a lot of TV. Like, I know that like a lot of these, the hearings and stuff, I'm fully aware that you, as I do mostly, but over the years I've been drawn in on many of these news stories, but I know you have a preternatural ability to ignore things in a good way. And so that's fascinating to think of you watching the proceedings.
In pain, I might add.
In pain. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And so you were at Fairhope. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Wow. And so what was the...
It was 4 days before you were born.
Oh, of course.
I'm sorry. No. It was 4 days. Billy was born in October. It was Billy's birth. Yeah.
It was 4 months.
It
before,
was four. It was
2 months before was Billy four, was born.
It was 4 days before your fourth birthday, which
there
I
you go.
Managed.
There you go.
I passed the kidney stone and managed to rally for your birthday.
Awesome.
And I've got pictures of all of us in those stupid pointy hats.
Okay. I remember those. So what was the mood around Fairhope regarding the resignation of Nixon?
I don't know. I was in so much pain, and well, you know, we thought he should have resigned. He broke the law. He lied. He was a rascal.
Yes, scoundrel.
He did all that sort of. I'm sure it had happened before, but again, it's the first time that it was on media, national media. Yep.
Well, and they had the tapes.
Yeah, they did.
Interesting. So was, had granddad been, or grandma, I think of granddad kind of being the, you know, the political force in the house. Did he, was he a fan of Nixon before the weirdness or no?
No.
Okay.
No.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. All right. So I'm going to, that one was great. Thank you for that. Next we have,
welcome.
You may guess this one as I say it too. I'm not sure, but, on April 30th, 1975, you were 31 and it was a Wednesday and it was the fall of Saigon.
Oh, I do remember that. 1975. Wow. 75. What day was it?
April 30th.
Wow. What is it with April?
It is. It's crazy.
There was huge national television coverage, of course. I remember the chaos. I remember standing there watching and feeling panicked in my own way, wondering what it would be like if that ever happened in the United States, or how horrid it would be. Right?
How helpless it. Yeah. It's, it's a chilling, just thinking about it is chilling. So chilling to me. And then of course, in recent history, watching what went down in Afghanistan, it was like, you never thought you'd see something like that again. And then in Afghanistan,
it was horrible. You know,
people falling off of planes they're clinging to and whatever. And it was like the similar thing over again. It's, and I guess that's sort of, or if that's when a, you know, when a city falls like that, it's, that's what happens. And it's,
it was terrifying watching those people on top of the embassy in Saigon, trying to get onto those helicopters and, you know, and the people on the helicopters trying to help them. And I mean, just the sheer terror of the whole thing. And I felt, you're exactly right. I felt that exact same thing in Afghanistan. I said to myself, you know, it's been 55 years. How can how long were we in Afghanistan? 20 years? How can this be happening again?
Yeah, it's no fun to lose, not to be pithy about it, but it's losing a war is no fun. And yeah, and then the classic image also, the helicopters taking off from the top of the embassy, but then also landing on the aircraft carriers and the military guys pushing the helicopters into the water to make room for the next ones to land because they didn't have room.
Yeah.
That's just such insanity. And just the thought of that being just the thing to do in the moment. And I'm not questioning what they did. It's just, it's the fact that that was the reality on the ground is just so insane.
Well, I mean, but think about this, think about the difference in political perspective. They wanted to save every American and everybody getting off that helicopter. Whereas, you know, in another situation, it might not have been that way.
Yeah. Yeah. True.
And again, you know, it's the value of life. It's your perception of the value of life, which I've told you my experience in Thailand, and life is not valued over there as much as it is here. And I guess I think it's more of a religious thing because they look forward to going to heaven or whatever their Buddhist resting place is. And the Western world doesn't, you know, it's a whole different philosophy.
It is. And it's interesting. It seems like there's pluses and minuses to both sides, but I don't think I don't think we have time for that philosophical conversation today.
I don't think, and I don't think it would change anything anyway. So
correct. Well, except for what's in our heads and how we experience things.
Exactly.
But again,
exactly.
I won't go down that path, as tempting as it is. All right. So next we have, this one's forever linked to my birthday because it happened on August 16th, 1977. And it was always in the news right around my birthday growing up, reminding us that on Tuesday, August 16th, 1977, when you were 33 and I was 7, Elvis died.
And as I said, that's not a...
Yeah, yep. Don't care about
that's
Elvis.
That's not a date. I care about Elvis. He was a human being, but... I'll tell you what, the angst and the carrying on of crazy women when Elvis died, it still blows my mind. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Whatever.
Well, his is interesting. You know, he's, he's an interesting character, as you brought up earlier when I was talking about the Hendrix, Joplin, Jim Morrison deaths, that Elvis, or no, I'm sorry, even earlier than that, when we were talking about Ed Sullivan, Beatles on Ed Sullivan, and you're saying how Elvis had been before them, and it's interesting is the wrong word, but it's curious to see his drug culture death, you know, seven exactly. years after the,
exactly. the people
who were young. So he was an older victim and a different victim, but another victim basically. So,
you know, I think I read somewhere that a lot of his, well, it was addiction obviously after a while, but was because of pain and, you know, I think about, that History of Country Music series that we watched, and a lot of those earlier country western singers who died of overdoses were taking the medications. Like, what's the guy's name from Alabama? You know, when you drive through, it's not Butler, but
Hank Williams.
Hank Williams, yeah. Anyway, you know, he had been in a car accident and had a serious either back or leg problem or something. And he was in excruciating pain, you know, driving all over the country doing gigs. And he basically just overdosed because of pain and addiction. You know, I mean, it's kind of one in the same. But I think there was something to do with Elvis, too. It wasn't strictly addiction, but it got to be addiction. Well, that's how Prince died. He had a broken hip or something and performed.
Prince and Tom Petty both were on basically taking fentanyl or whatever it is for initially legitimate, you know, pain issues from jumping around on stage, yeah. et cetera. And I think Tom Petty's was, I don't think his was fentanyl. He was taking heavy drugs for a hip problem. That were thought
and had a heart attack as a result. Yeah,
correct. At the end of a long, grueling tour, last night of a grueling tour, you know. So it's it's that, you know, that road life can be rough for a lot of different reasons. And So it's anyway. Okay. Well, so next we have another musician death, but this one, and this is the first event in this entire list that I remember. And this would be, we were living in Missoula, and it was on December 8th, 1980, when John Lennon was shot.
Yeah, I remember that. Wow. I just remember seeing it on TV, and I remember it was like, yeah, it was a big deal because they were adored. The Beatles were adored.
Yeah. Even in their, they were having their successful solo careers and whatnot. I remember it. I can't remember if Richard and Jan still lived in Missoula then or not, but I, for some reason,
I think they did.
I think they did too, because I feel like Jan took it pretty hard. And my most distinct memory though is that there was a Time magazine with John Lennon's face on it that was stuck in the magazine rack for like probably a year and a half in the blue TV room.
Yeah.
And then the other piece that I think is connected is there was those two Beatles 8-track greatest hits, the red out, I think everybody calls them just the red album and the blue album. There's a greatest hits that's from their earlier days, and then another greatest hits from their second half of their career. And we played that, and it's interesting because I don't remember listening to a ton of Beatles growing up, except for that little distinct period of time where we wore those 8-tracks out. And I only remember listening to them in the Missoula house because that's the only place we ever had an 8-track. And I don't think we had, for some silly reason, we never had those on any other media. Like when we converted to cassette, we didn't get versions of those.
We did not. Yeah, that's funny.
I so distinctly remember those album covers. It's the same picture of them leaning over a stairwell looking down. And one of them,
I remember those. Yeah.
One of them's got a red border on it and the other one's got a blue border on it. And they're great. The greatest hits albums, the kind of that my generation was definitely introduced to the Beatles through those two albums. Yeah. So
can I interject here?
Please do.
Can we take a quick break?
Yes. Okay. Well, you'll likely be glad to know that we are a good bit more than halfway through everything here. So we're moving right along. So after John Lennon in 1980, the next one is also a shooting. and while we were in Missoula, and it was March 30th, 1981, a Monday, when Ronald Reagan, president, was shot. You were 37 and I was 10. And I both remember this one and have a story about it, but I'll let you go first.
Well, all I remember is President Nixon was getting out of his car, right? Or coming, walking down the stairs from something. And what was his name? John Hinckley pulled a gun out and shot him. And that James
Brady,
his
Secret Service.
Thank you. His Secret Service guy, Jim Brady, stepped out in front of him, and he actually got hit in the head, I think,
and the spine, I believe, and was paralyzed.
Yeah, and subsequently, they named the Brady Law, which I can't remember what it's about, but it has to do with the shootings and whatever.
It has to do with gun control.
Gun control, yeah, and yeah, Reagan. I'm not sure he got hit. Did he?
He did. Yes.
He did. And the big deal was that they had to turn the presidency over to whoever was the VP at the time. Was it Ford or
Bush?
Wasn't it? Bush. I don't know. I can't remember.
The first Bush. Yeah, it was the first Bush, wasn't it? He was Reagan's vice, wasn't he?
I can't remember. Obviously, it didn't make an impression on me.
Yeah, it was the elder Bush. It's got to be. I can't believe we don't know this.
I can't either. Quick. Look it up.
Yeah, of course. It was George H.W.
Bush. Yeah, of course it was.
And very young looking George H.W. Bush.
And then he became the next president.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you don't have any specific memory. I'm sure you were just running around Missoula probably.
I just remember seeing it on TV and hearing, you know, the updates. And
I remember being in fifth grade in Mrs. Nakamura's class at Paxton Elementary. And it was in the afternoon when it happened. And they wheeled the TV into the library and had all the fifth grade classes, or not the library, but like this, the fifth grade middle room. I don't know what they called it, like the conference room for fifth graders. And I'm sure did it for the other grades also in their own separate conference rooms. But wheeled the TV in there and turned on the news, and everybody was sitting in there watching it, and they had not had that TV on for 2 minutes. And I remember I was sitting in the front row on the floor with, I have to think it was this guy, Graham, that I had this, he and I were kind of, I guess you'd call them frenemies these days. We had like serious competitions over math in particular. Like we were the two best math students in the room, and we would always tease and heckle one another over math, like the nerds that we were. And I can't remember what happened, but he and I did something and laughed or something, and it felt like we had done nothing. But Mrs. Nakamura snatched the two of us, and I didn't get in trouble in school really. I mean, very rarely. And I will say, Graham and I would, like in fifth and sixth grade, both we did kind of push the limits on our teachers a little bit, but only in the way that two math nerds can. And she snatched us up and took us back to the classroom and gave us some super boring writing assignment, like, you know, basically copying something down. And we didn't get to see another hint of that thing, and I was just completely taken off guard, and I didn't feel bad because I didn't feel like I'd done anything bad, but it was kind of nice to be in the classroom alone with Graham, and because like she went back and watched the thing and stuff, and so, but I did not have any understanding of how serious everything was. And looking back, like the president had been shot. We didn't know if he was going to live at that time. And so it was a much more somber moment than it feels looking back on it, you know?
But you were 10 years old.
Correct. Correct.
Think about Brody. Okay.
Oh, there you go. Well, that's, yeah. And so, anyway, no, I'm not, I'm just saying it's kind of funny to think back on.
Yeah.
All right. This next one. January 28th, 1986. It was a Tuesday. I also have a very distinct memory of this one. It was the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster.
Yeah, I remember that too. In fact, it gives me the chills right now. I was driving back from Gold's Gym over there on Lee Trevino, back to Richard's office on 7888 Gateway West.
Oh, yeah. Know it well.
And I had the radio on. I was in the Green Jaguar, and I heard it. I mean, you know, it was like an explosive come on, you know, an interruption in the radio. And it was like, you know, the guy was like screaming and sounded like he was crying. And it was just like, yeah. And of course, when I got back to the office, turned it on, and oh my God, it was, I'm sure you've seen video of that.
So I
horrible explosion.
Well, I didn't watch it in real time, but I was watching. So I was at El Paso High. I was 15, so I must have been in. Was I a freshman or sophomore. Eighth grade? Sophomore. Yeah, I guess sophomore.
Well, freshman or sophomore? Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to my third. Yeah, it was definitely freshman. Or I was not eighth grade because I was not in that eighth grade hall. I was up on the second floor. And I can't remember what class I was coming from, but I was going to third period world history with Mr. Rubenstein. And we didn't know what had happened. History class was one of those classes at El Paso High that was not an honors class. So history and social studies were always much more interesting group of kids than my honors group. Which was just a funny aside on El Paso High, but so Mr. Rubenstein, and we never watched films in that class, but he was rolling in a television again, just like Mrs. Nakamura did however many years before, rolled in a TV and turned it on without saying anything, like, and you know, we were all kind of like, what's going on here? And it was coverage of the live news afterwards. And I was sitting in that room for that hour. I watched that explosion probably 30 times over and over on the TV. It was chilling, and it was sad mostly, you know, but it was, it was weird. And I don't remember what happened the rest of the day. I'm sure school continued on that day, but I don't have any memory of the other classes. Like, I don't remember watching it all day or anything. After third period, we would have gone to lunch.
Yeah.
I don't remember any of the rest of the day, but I do remember just and of course the aftermath of it just being such a big, you know, investigation in the news for so many months afterwards. But it was definitely one of these bolts from the blue, like a handful of these topics we've discussed have been, some more than others.
Yeah. And it was Sally Ride, and wasn't she the first female?
You're thinking of Kirsten McCullough.
Kirsten McCullough. Okay. Yeah. But she was a teacher.
She was a teacher.
Teacher.
Sally Ride did not, I don't think, died on the space shuttle. She lived and was famous for being maybe one of the first women in space. I could be wrong about that, but she, Kirsten McCullough, I believe, was the first civilian and first woman.
I think you're right.
First woman civilian, obviously. And yes, she was a teacher, and that was a big part of it also.
It's a big deal. Yeah.
And it was just at that point when it was kind of becoming quote unquote normal for the space shuttle to be going up. And it felt like we were in the future. And then we got yanked back.
Yeah.
And we're really honestly just recovering from it now in terms of space starting to become a semi-normal ambition again.
Yeah. Who was it that ditched the NASA program? Which president?
It feels like it's just been a ongoing spiral down, but it, I don't know. I think Clinton and the second Bush both, and Obama got a bunch of criticism about it also. It's been, I mean, obviously it's never completely gone away, but it's, it's morphed. And I can't remember, there was, and it actually was I mean, as much as I am a NASA fanboy and think it's, you know, the best government agency and love the idea of it and everything, I do understand the argument and have, and we're seeing it come to fruition now of moving towards NASA working with private industry to get into space.
Yeah.
And that needing to happen in order for it to ever take the next steps.
Yeah.
But I'll forever have a soft spot for NASA. And I wish they would get more funding. It's interesting. I never thought I would have doubts about space endeavors, but I've come around to wonder if we should be doing it at all, because it's a big, like, there's a lot of things we need to fix here. And I mean, the argument of, I understand the Hawking principle of, if we're going to live forever, we're going to have to leave Earth. And so I do believe we need to be on that trajectory, but at the same time, we've gotten to this point where, with climate change and the stuff we're doing to the Earth, to be spending all this money trying to get to Mars seems absurd. And I don't know. It's more complicated than it used to be for me, I guess, like a lot of things. I don't know. It's interesting with, like, with space getting all junked up too, like the Russians just exploded this satellite in a way that looks intentional. That's kind of like, if we can't play up there, you can't either. We're going to ruin it for everybody. And that, the idea of that happening, the idea of us not being able to leave Earth because there's too much trash to get out is super
disturbing.
Depressing. Yes.
Yeah.
Super depressing. Particularly the idea of a nation state causing that is really just is chilling.
And that reminds me of COVID, and I still have these weird thoughts that, is this a sci-fi moment where China invented this virus that, as soon as we think we have one variant under control, another one pops up? I mean, it's terrifying.
Yeah, well, that would happen naturally also, but it is, whether it was accidental or malicious, the whole lab theory is not necessarily a super cuckoo conspiracy thing. It could very well be what caused this.
Absolutely.
And if it did happen, it was actually more likely an accident than on purpose, I will say, in my opinion. It's the idea of, even with China, the idea of this level of conspiracy is a little out there to me, particularly for something that's going to affect their own situation. Yeah. I don't know. But all that aside, I do think we are living in a time where the reality of the labs we have, I've read stuff about the scientists that go out and go into these caves looking for this guano to do these experiments, to actually find these viruses and then take them back to a lab. That is how you find these things, and it could have gotten distributed that way just as easily as coming out of the wet market. So,
well, you know, I think about Matt Green and those months and months he spent at a time in the deep, dark jungles on a river, you know, living in a tent with one of those, what do you call those radios, like that one Bruce gave you, a shortwave radio as his, and BBC is his only communication with the world, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, it also reminds me of when the first nuclear bomb was tested. The scientists weren't sure. There was scientific theory at the time that said that if you set this bomb off, it's going to cause a chain reaction that's basically going to envelop the atmosphere of the Earth and kill us all. Like they weren't sure that wasn't going to happen. Well, just like when the Hadron Collider or whatever it was in CERN in Switzerland did all that stuff recently, it was like they weren't sure they weren't going to create a black hole accidentally. They were pretty sure, but they weren't sure. And so, which is, I mean, I in a way I love it. I mean, scientific progress is great, but it's, these scientists going out into these bat caves are never quite sure if they're going to bring something nasty home that wouldn't have otherwise come home. So crazy.
Or if they're going to get taken out, you know, I mean,
that's, yeah, no, that's
touch what, something that, yeah.
So, Anyway, okay, well, that was an interesting aside on the space shuttle disaster, but the next event I have for us is, and this, we're moving into my college years here, and this is another one that was a little bit of a, this one could be argued to be the slowest, or the longest, slowest boil of all of these, in terms of, you know, things like the Bay of Pigs and the Tet Offensive that we talked about earlier. But this would be November 9th, 1989, the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Yeah. yeah, that was a slow burn, and that to me, well, of course it was all televised too. That to me was like a positive, extremely exciting moment.
Absolutely. No, it was something we never thought would happen. Like, it was
no, ever.
For some reason I remember, and I guess it was because I was probably home for Thanksgiving right after it, but I remember most of my memories are watching the news in El Paso, even though I had been at Vanderbilt when it actually happened. And I think I didn't watch much news when I was at Vanderbilt. So I wasn't as in touch as I would be now, but I remember how thrilling it was. And that's interesting. It was right. And it was, I forget how close it was to right before I went over there. I don't think I knew I was going over yet to view England, that is.
Yeah.
But I remember just how, like, and even in spite of the fact that like Reagan was so involved in it and all, it was still, I could put that aside and still enjoy it.
Exactly. Well, and yeah, it was just, it's interesting to talk to Bruce about that because I think he was living or stationed in Germany. When did the wall actually go up? 75? No, before that.
I'll tell you. Keep talking and I'll tell you.
But Bruce knew it before and after, you know, and Berlin is one of his favorite, not one of his favorites, but a favorite city now. When I think he's been back over there 3 or 4 times because he says they have the most fabulous museums on the east side, you know, that you could never have gone to before. And I remember the first time he went by himself because Barbara Ann didn't want to go. And I guess after getting back and him telling her how amazing and unbelievable it was and the museums and, you know, the history and everything, that she went the next time, 2 times, I think he went.
So that's, yeah. So my memories of it. So it was erected in 1961.
61. Okay.
And so, he must've known it from when he was in high school there or whatever.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I went to Berlin in the winter when I was on winter break in England in 1990, which would have been
when you got sick, wasn't it?
Berlin was where I got the antibiotics and started feeling better and could actually get out and enjoy the city eventually because we spent several days there. But yes, Berlin was the peak of my illness there, which we could do a whole other episode about, but we'll talk about that some other time. But I was on antibiotics and had been given a breathing treatment and was authorized to get out in the winter air and had that jubilance and, you know, that feeling you have after you've been sick where you feel like you're well again, kind of. And
yeah,
it's like you feel bulletproof.
The return of energy.
The realizing that you are not going to feel like that for the rest of your life. And so anyway, so we got to, we of course got to go see the remnants at that time of the wall. And there was all these local, not all these guys, but where there was still pieces of it standing, because it wasn't like perfectly wiped out or anything. You know, there was still, I'm sure it's probably by now, or maybe there's a little memorial of it or something, but it was, there's still big pieces of it left. And there was guys out there with their hammers chipping pieces off and selling them.
Memorabilia,
which precluded us from going up and doing it ourselves. We didn't feel like we had the permission or whatever, although we probably could have, I don't know, or we didn't have hammers either. But I did, this is one of my greatest regrets of my travels in Europe, is I purchased a baggie full of stones from they had graffiti on them and stuff. It was, you know, it was awesome. Yeah. Little, you know, chunks, none of them even the size of my fist, like stuff you could carry in your backpack. But little pieces that were legitimately from the Berlin Wall that I'd watched him chip off. And I carried those things around in my backpack the entire visit over there. and had them in my dorm room or my flat room in Leeds. And I have no memory of ever having them ever since. I don't know where. My theory is that my flatmate, Tony Zaffirini, stole them because he was a history buff and kind of a dick. Although he had his own that he bought on that same day. I shouldn't call him out like that because he's probably innocent. But that's the only explanation I have, because I was more casual about them at the time than I am now, because I knew they were cool and I knew I wanted to keep them, but I didn't. Like, now when I think about it, it's like, oh my God, I had that. And it's like something I could have now if I hadn't lost them. But
it's like moon rock.
Yeah. One of those handfuls of things in my life where I've had something and lost it. I'm glad there aren't more. Anyway, so that was my,
at least you have the memory.
I have the memory, and I was there, and there's probably a picture of me somewhere in my box there. And then we also, and what you were saying earlier about Berlin, East Berlin, we got to, you know, we got to walk wherever we wanted. I don't know that there was museums ready for us at that time. I'm sure maybe there were, because it wasn't like there was a war or anything when the wall came down, but we didn't, the guidebooks didn't have a bunch of information about East Berlin or anything. And so we did go walk.
And I'm not sure that they were that good then, because the East Berlin was impoverished. You know?
That's my memory of it. Like, we walked probably 6 blocks into East Berlin and kind of around about a little bit, enough to get the experience of, you know, at the time, everything was like gray or tan. Like, it definitely had that, like,
yes,
communist feeling. All the cars were those classic ugly Yugo looking, you know, just box cars in gray,
black squares. Yeah.
Not even black. Black would have been nice. They were like gray, brown turd cars.
China when I went.
Yeah. And so it didn't have there was nothing to buy, nowhere to eat, nothing. It was like there was not a lot to do other than experience it. But I'm glad we did. And I didn't understand geography well enough at the time to realize that we had to go through East Germany to get to Berlin on the train. Like, we were, I was out of it on, because I was sick on the way to Berlin.
So, yeah.
From Amsterdam to Berlin. And we were on a nice train. But when we left Berlin, we learned every time we got a new train over there, we learned something new. And when we left Berlin, we had, and it was one of those, sometimes we knew where we were going. Other times we'd be, you know, done with the city, but not know where we wanted to go next. And that was the case when we left Berlin. And so we were literally doing that thing, standing in the train station, looking at the trains leaving. And we said, let's get on that one to Hanover. That'll get us towards Munich, which was where we wanted to go eventually. And so we got on this train, and it turned out to be this East German train. And it was in the East German conductors. It was okay. Like, we were allowed on it, and our Eurorail passes worked amazingly on it. But it was this it was like all the interior was super sparse and wooden, like wooden benches you sat on.
Because
most of the European trains at that time were super nice, or at least,
yeah,
at least either. Well, occasionally we'd do the opposite and accidentally get on a really nice train and have to pay extra above it because our student pass would only cover it partially. But this case was the opposite of that, which was, we got on this train and it was like, you know, and it kind of made you seasick because it kind of swayed and it was super slow. Yeah. And it was like, and we got to Hanover at like 2 a.m. and ended up, this was one of only a handful, but there were a handful of nights where we basically had to sleep like out somewhere, and it was cold as hell in Hanover. So we found this room, which was this lobby at the train station, but it was basically the bum drunk tank, it turned out. And we, the four of us, huddled with our backpacks as barriers in a corner, and looking back, but it was a lot scarier night for Natasha than any of the rest of us. She was the only girl in the entire room, there was more than one creep in there calling her out. It was an uncomfortable evening. Yes, I was still on antibiotics and still still just getting over my illness. But hey, I was young.
That's right.
So that is my Berlin Wall.
I've been there too. Yes. I understand.
That was my Berlin Wall digression, and this episode's getting a little long in the tooth, I know, but I've got just a handful of more modern things here. We can probably skip through these pretty quickly, although we don't have to. I'm delighted to have an extra long episode with you too, should it turn out that way. On February 26, 1993, I was 48, or you were 48, I was 22. So I was out of Vanderbilt and living in Austin at this point. And the first World Trade Center bombing happened.
Yeah.
Which, looking back, seems like a no big deal because it was kind of a dud.
I was going to say that
it was
the first of what's to come.
It was the dawning of the modern war era we live in, it seems like.
Yeah.
Although, no, that's not true, because the Iraq war had happened before that, the first Iraq war. But this was kind of the first thing on U.S. soil. And my memory of it, and this is going to play into basically the next three or four things, is a couple of things conspiring together here. First of all, I was out of Vanderbilt, living in Austin, and quote unquote working from home. So I had exposure to cable news for the first time in forever. And it was still a relatively new thing. And it was my first memory of that kind of, you know, that sort of 24/7 news cycle that that's come to dominate our lives in such a horrendous way. But it was one of my first experiences with that during a national crisis or whatever. And so I definitely remember that about it. And just kind of in it being sort of my, like, that literally happened 3 days after I moved to Austin.
Wow.
Anyway, and that's my memory of it, sitting in the Mole house, kind of semi-depressed at having left Austin and wondering what I was going to do and how long I was going to be in Austin and whether my Desert Medical Branch office was going to work out, and learning to live with Natasha alone for the first time. And it was quite a time.
Starting a new life,
indeed. Do you have any particular memories of that incident or anything?
I just remember thinking how horrible again, you know, but it didn't make the impression that a lot of those other events we've discussed tonight did, which is sad, because I guess it meant that with the 24/7 news, we were getting more used to those horrendous events. And I will say, and I may have mentioned this, I know I've mentioned this to you before, but we were in Sun Valley in 1982, and we had been skiing all day. It was cold, and we had skied hard and long. And then we had come home and probably had a few drinks and had gotten in the hot tub. And as each person got out of the hot tub, I think there were, what, two or three bedrooms in that house we were staying in, Peterson's house, you know, that they rented and that we lived in for a while. And so people wandered downstairs and probably fixed another drink and sat down in that living room with the TV on CNN, you know, it was a whole, and I don't think any of us even realized, you know, we were not huge TV watchers in Missoula because we were always so active, you know, I remember a good amount of time in the TV room, but it didn't consume our lives and we didn't have it on day and night.
My memory of that is interesting because we had HBO existed for the first time and Richard had access to HBO. And so we watched a ton of movies and stuff like that, more so.
Yeah, we did. I was going to say, I remember family movies. Yeah.
Yeah. My memory is much more of watching movies, family, and probably a lot of movies I shouldn't have been watching as well in my memory.
Richard.
With Richard and with you. I remember watching Hair, for one thing. That was my first film nudity was in Hair. That was, you know, it was eye-opener.
Anyway, so what were we talking about? We were talking about,
1982, CNN, after the hot
1982. Tub. 1982, CNN. So, yeah, a hot tub. And then we all of us wandered downstairs. Ben Westbrook was there, and Sarah and Arnie and Richard and Jan and me and Steve Garman, I think. Anyway, we wandered downstairs. When all of us finally got down to the living room, we sat down and everybody fell sound asleep. We were so exhausted, you know, from skiing all day in the hot tub and having several drinks. And we woke up right before midnight and somebody said, what time is it? Ben Westbrook looked at his watch. He was like, it's almost midnight. What are we going to have for supper? Nothing's going to be open. It was the first time that we had realized that 24/7 news was on, right? Because every time somebody would come down or wake up or something, it'd be the same thing over and over again.
The news is still on.
The same program. The news is still on. Yeah.
That's hilarious.
That was our first experience. And I do remember that Ben Westbrook ended up fixing some delicious eggs and tortillas and whatever, you know.
Good job, Ben.
Yeah, and we ate about 2:30 in the morning. It was like, holy cow, what knocked us in the head? Yeah, it was weird.
That's great. All right, so this next topic is another sort of slow boil, ending with a bad thing, and it's right. It's 2 days after. Hold on. Yeah, it's 2 days after the World Trade Center bombing on the 2nd of February, or I'm sorry, February 28th, 1993. Can that be right? That doesn't seem right. This is the Waco siege. And I'm sorry. It's April 19th, 1993. Yeah, okay, I got the wrong date on that. It started on February, but the siege was on April 19th. And that's why, because I moved to Austin on February 23rd, 1993. And the siege started on the 28th, but then, and it's another April event here, April 19th was when the ATF went in and, you know, did all the actual
damage.
Siege, which ended the event. And again, I had, you know, since being here and having cable news and whatever, and of course Waco being just 100 miles up the road, it was a massive coverage nationwide, I'm sure, also, but here in particular, just a daily, everything, just nonstop news about Waco for 2 months there, and then ending in this horrific siege. And I remember watching it live on the news,
me too,
the chapel or whatever it was on fire and the agents going in and all that, and which was real time, I think. And it was
yeah,
super crazy.
I think it was too. Yeah. We were in El Paso, obviously. I was in El Paso with
Billy and
Laura. And it was on the news nonstop out there too. And it was, it was like one of those, it's like O.J. Simpson. People sat there for 22 hours and watched that that car chase. It was similar to that. You got sick of it, but you didn't want to take your eyes off of it, right?
Okay, so you'll be glad to know that I forgot to put the O.J. Simpson car chase in here, and I'll let that be your only reference to it.
Okay, I'm good with that.
Okay, on that note, I'm going to skip ahead another year to another April event, April 5th, 1994, and this is my first memory that I have. Oh, well, not my first memory of this, but this is the first memory on this list where I was in the house that I'm sitting in right now.
Oh, wow.
And which is crazy because according to this document, I was 23 at the time and you were 50. So I've been in this house. Good geez. Okay. Let's not do that math. Okay. So this is the Kurt Cobain suicide.
Oh, yeah. I do remember that well for some reason. Well, he was kind of one of those iconic, he was kind of wasn't he the forefront in the forefront of his style of music? That
he was the poster boy for grunge, if you will.
Grunge, I couldn't think of the word.
I would say the involuntary poster boy for grunge, I would go so far as to say.
Yeah.
The lead singer and guitarist of Nirvana. My memory of that is I was sitting in what's now my dining room, but at that time was my office, on the computer listening to KGSR, interestingly, back in the early Austin years, before I had switched over to KUT, and when KGSR was kind of the station of Austin in terms of what everyone was tuned into, the pulse of Austin was KGSR. And I remember Jody Denberg, who to this day is a KUT DJ, came on and announced it. And, you know, did the whole suicide hotline, if you're feeling bad about this thing, and started playing Nirvana songs. And it was, and I, you know, I was, I'm actually a lot more of a Nirvana fan now than I was then. I didn't dislike them, but it took me a while to warm up to grunge. But it was very impactful. I mean, he had been him and Courtney Love and their daughter and, traipsing around the world, getting arrested in every city in Europe for not taking care of their kid and all that. The whole 2 years leading up to his death was just kind of like a John and Yoko kind of level of celebrity. And then the suicide, it was a impactful and sad day. Maybe it's funny, maybe it's not, I'm not sure. But the one thing I do remember is I had not watched MTV in forever. And I do remember turning on MTV that day and Kurt Loder, the MTV news DJ and, you know, famous Rolling Stone reporter, being basically on their kind of wall to wall coverage again, reaching out to the teenagers out there saying, you know, don't do this, it's not a good idea, and call the suicide hotline and all that kind of stuff. And just I feel like it was my first, probably not my first, but it was a very memorable kind of national suicide. And it was a sad day.
Yeah, agreed. And I've felt kind of like, although, you knew the garage bands and some of the stuff coming out of Seattle, but it really put Seattle on the map as a music spot.
Absolutely. I mean, previously it's originally where Jimi Hendrix was from, and there's some what's the rapper, Sir Mix-a-Lot. I like Big Butts. Some hits had come out of Seattle, but grunge really put it on the map.
Yeah, it did. So Ben, is it getting dark there?
It is starting to get dark here, but I see if we go on too much longer, I'm going to not be able to see you. It's a good thing this is an audio medium. We have four more items. Would you like to push through them, or should we?
I would like to do them. If you will hold on 1 second, I'll go open up a couple of blinds and we'll be able to see each other.
Okay.
Okay. Is that better?
That is better. That's some delightful golden hour light you've got going on there.
Yeah. It's those winter early sunsets are. Mm-hmm. We're rounding the corner to the shortest day of the year. So.
We are. It's almost on us. Wow, this is I don't think we've taken a break on any of our podcasts so far, and today we've taken two. This is one for the ages. Two weeks after Kurt Cobain's suicide a year and 2 weeks on April 19th, again, April 19th, same day as the Waco siege, April 19th, 1995. And sort of a hat tip to the Waco siege would be the Oklahoma City bombing.
That was terrifying to me it was terrifying. It was miserable and horrible at the time, but to find out that actually an American had done it was pretty disturbing to me. It made me realize that we have a lot of serious and unhappy factions in our country.
Yes, the malcontents. And I remember, this is one of those bolt from the blue items. You know, I remember coming home one afternoon to this house and finding out about it. It felt like, of course, initially, famously, you know, all the news outlets immediately jumped to the conclusion that it was Islamic terrorism.
Exactly.
And then I think within a day or two, we knew that it was Timothy McVeigh. The scary thing at the time about it was it felt like this could be a new normal, and thankfully that has not turned out. But even with all the tumult of the last 5 or 6 years, we haven't seen anything quite like that, thankfully. But it did feel like, okay, this is when, you know, the daycare and the, like, there was a,
I know,
and just the, it was the targeting of American citizens without any kind of remorse, like that was something new, or felt like something new.
It did.
And you would have still been in El Paso then, or had you moved to Florida, or do you remember?
I was right before I moved to Florida. I moved to Florida in September of 95.
Gotcha. So, and I'm sure there's some more events in here, but I can't remember any of them. So the next one is, you know, probably the biggest one on the whole list for the cusp of my lifetime and maybe yours, would be 9/11/2001.
Yep.
I'll let you go first. Do you remember that morning?
Of course. I know exactly where I was and what I was doing, because it happened right around 9 o'clock, as I recall. I was in the bathroom drying my hair, and I had the Today Show on. And I heard that, you know, an airplane was headed, late breaking news. We're interrupting this program to bring you some late breaking news, right? And the late breaking news was an airplane is headed for one of the Twin Towers in New York City. And then they showed, you know, they showed it hitting the tower, and then the second one. And then the Pentagon, and then Flight 93 that was diverted. You know, I mean, it was, yeah.
And then the towers.
It was a horror. It was a horror show. Yeah.
And that was all within the course of like 4 or 5 hours or less.
Yeah.
My memory of it is a little bit different in that I had spent the night at Talia's apartment over there on Spyglass, and I had gotten up to come home to go to work at School People. School People was gone by then. I had come home just to go to work at home, or I was headed home, and I, on my way home, stopped by what at the time was the only Taco Deli there at the bottom of Spyglass off of Barton Creek. And I went in, and I was the only person in there except for the guy running the counter, which was one of the owner guys that you never see anymore. But and he told me, he was like, something happened in New York apparently, and at the time it was when the first plane had hit, and he said, you know, apparently some Cessna or something flew into the World Trade Center, and because they didn't even know it was at that point
747,
at that point it had not made it out that it was a 747. And so I got my tacos and got in the car and turned off my music and turned on the news. And as I was driving home, was getting the news feed about the stuff. And as I was driving home, the second plane hit. And then I remember running inside. And that was when Laura and Brian were living here. And their bedroom was this room that I'm sitting in right now, is my office. And of course, Laura had Good Morning America or whatever, or Today Show. She wasn't cheating on you. She also still watches the Today Show to this day. And she had the Today Show on, and they were, you know, we were stumbling over ourselves to tell each other what was going on, and quickly synced up. And then I went back to my bedroom where my office was at that time, because there were so many people living here, and got on my computer and started looking at pages, or starting looking at the news sites. And everywhere was so overwhelmed that all the websites were down. And then,
wow,
eventually they started coming back in text only mode. And I've got screenshots that I was in the moment enough to take screenshots of the, like, CNN homepage and the Yahoo homepage and the, you know, the news sites of the day. And it was literally text on a white page, because they couldn't, that was all they could get out. The news, the surge for news was so overwhelming, and definitely the first time that, like, that level of news surge had happened. And of course,
yeah.
And some of the, it was interesting to see, to me as a, you know, as a internet nerd, was interesting to see the different news people or the different news websites react, and how quickly they could get back online, and how they came back online. And all that was a little side alley of interestingness. And of course I also had the TV on behind me and was getting news that way, but it was just a, I mean, a, it was a crazy, life-changing morning. And the fact that, and I mean, and we're still heavily, heavily living with the consequences of it. Although, you know, everything from the TSA making you take your shoes off to, like, I believe Trump being president was all, that's all part of the whatever you call it, the fallout from 9/11.
Yeah. Well, I'll, and I will say one thing, and I'm not sure that this is completely accurate. I was never really afraid when your dad was in Vietnam. In my heart, I always felt like he would come home, and he did. But maybe that was just stupidity and youth and whatever.
It's optimism.
Optimism. But I felt real fear in my heart that morning when I saw what happened in New York. It was terrifying.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe the first time in my life that I really felt, wow, something could happen, you know.
Well, and it was such a, I mean, for lack of a better word, such an elegant attack, the way, I mean, the way it happened in three different cities, and it really felt like, I mean, it really took the wind out of everything for a while there.
It was the precision of it and the secrecy of it. And it reminded me of the atomic bomb, you know, the secrecy of the development in New Mexico in a mountain far away that nobody knew about, right? Los Alamos.
You got it. All right. Getting a little exhausted here, but we've got two.
So Ben, I'm this is just so weird. I look like my head is highlighted here, mm-hmm. and you're in the total darkness.
Yeah, my
so
lighting
a light
just
above your computer.
My 6:30 lighting trigger just changed the lighting in the house, and it's not optimal for podcasting, but it's a good thing that we only have to hear each other.
I look like I'm being interrogated. So go ahead.
Okay. So, and this one is interesting also in the, it's as horrible as some of these other things, but in the context of these other things, it didn't seem as bad or something, or that's the wrong way to say it. But it's so on February 1st, 2003, we had the Space Shuttle Columbia disaster, which is the one that fell apart on reentry and strewed the,
yes,
remains all over Texas and several other states, which there was so much going on, and I was so overwhelmed with news, and it kind of stopped listening to the news, and it was and so I feel like I kind of checked out on this one, but at the same time it was also so horrible, and the idea of falling apart on the way home, I don't know if somehow is even worse than the blowing up on the way out. I don't know why, but it's
Well, it's like you've completed your mission and then, wow, it's over, right?
You know? Also, I think that they on the way up, it blew up instantly and out of nowhere. On the way back, they knew it was falling apart.
Like, yeah, they did.
It's and there's a great song called The Commander Thinks Aloud, which is...
I know that song. Yeah.
It's a chilling song about the disaster. It's a great song. That disaster, I do remember waking up, it happened like in the early hours, and I remember waking up to the news and then just the people trudging through the East Texas piney woods looking for remnants was just so creepy but inspiring also, and just really horrible and
body parts and
all that. So this next one I think we can touch on briefly, but it actually opens up a whole nother topic that we'll do another podcast on.
Okay.
And this one is August 29th, 2005, when
Hurricane Katrina
made landfall in Louisiana, and it was obviously a huge event on multiple levels, and it made me think that at some point in the future, I want to do a podcast just on hurricanes, kind of like we did today, but kind of go through some of the famous hurricanes in our lives and on the national stage as well. Since it's been such a part of our lives ever since we've been going to the beach, but particularly since you've been living there.
Yeah.
So
agreed.
Do you have any particular memories of that you want to lay out while we're here, or should we just hold that for a future episode?
Well, let's just hit on Katrina briefly. So as when every hurricane comes into the Gulf, you know, the TV is on the Weather Channel 24/7, and this hurricane was increasing in intensity. And as I recall, was heading more in our direction. So we were watching it very carefully to see if we needed to get out of town. And then it turned and was headed towards the Louisiana coast. And for a while, looked like it was going to remain a three. But then in the last hours, it gained strength, or maybe the day or two before. And I think New Orleans realized that they were unprepared, but they didn't know what to do. It was the end of August. We saw that it was not going to hit us. So I stayed here, but we were watching, you know, to see what it was like. And as the intensity grew and it was too late to evacuate, I think the nation realized that New Orleans was going to see a huge disaster, since it is lower than sea level. And all it has is those old and not well-kept levees to protect it. It was impending doom. And especially since they couldn't evacuate most of those people. Those people could not evacuate. They didn't have, in the Ninth Ward, they didn't have vehicles. There was no public transportation. They were basically trapped like rats in a sewer.
And the bridges
they could not get out. Yeah. And they couldn't get out. I mean, you know, the worst thing in a hurricane, well, there are many bad things, but one of the most dangerous things in a hurricane is to wait too late to evacuate. And then you can't get out. You know, we live, it doesn't seem like it, but we live on a barrier island here.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you don't get out before the winds hit 50 miles an hour, you don't get out. And then all the people who wait till the last minute to think they can get out and they can't, you know, it's disaster piled up on disaster. But yeah, the Katrina hurricane was just horrific. And then, of course, as it seems like it always happens, it hits the people who can afford it the least, or can't dig back up, can't recover, yeah. Can't, you know. I mean, in the flooding, it was such a disaster on multiple levels that I don't even know how to address it. You know, the storm itself, the flooding, the homeless, the deaths, the inability of the federal government to respond.
Yeah, the aftermath for weeks and months. And I mean, Austin, you could say that Austin still is different because of it. So many people moved here from Louisiana in the wake of that. It was,
yeah,
I mean, I remember for a while there, it was, you know, downtown was just full of, you know, of New Orleans refugees. Not on the streets, but like staying and just being
exactly.
In Austin. And it, you know, it gave a whole new flavor to the Austin scene for at least a year there. And then, and like I said, to this day, I know some of those people, like particularly the musicians, are still just set up camp here.
And same way here, of course, you know?
Of course, yep.
And we have, you know, as a result, we have a couple of, probably four or five really great New Orleans restaurants here, because they moved here and said, we're not going back, right?
And we call that a silver lining.
Yes, we do.
All right.
Yeah, Katrina is still a big word around here, let me tell you.
Oh, absolutely.
I think you will recall that Katrina is the reason that I called you guys and I think Laura and Brian, and said, can any of you, I'll pay for a van, to rent a van, if any of you can come down here and unload our storage shed with all the family archives.
Oh, that, of course.
And that's when we moved everything.
Well, no, yeah. I remember that vividly. It was, of course, that's when that was. And that started that whole wave of our redisbursement of our archives.
Yeah, because I said, listen, if a Katrina ever hit here, that storage shed would be gone. Everything else would be gone too. I mean, a 30-foot wave is a lot of water. We're at 31 feet here at our house. So, you know, it would have It would affect it. And that's when I took out flood insurance. We're not even in a flood zone here, but it can happen. Peace of mind. It's worth $450 a year.
I would say you're right. All right. Wow. Well,
historic.
Historic is a good word. I was going to say I had fun talking to you, but it's a little bit overwhelming to be rehashing all these negative events. I'm glad we had a few positive things in there, and I'm going to say, yeah, that was we'll wait until it's edited and everyone else gets to hear it, but I'm going to call this diversion a success for now. And
me too. And I will say that you know, it's history, and it's what we deal with in life, and we're still standing here, and we're still hoping for the best and moving towards the future, and it's all good.
It is all good. I have a heartwarming story to tell you to wrap everything up. I may have already told it to you, but did I tell you my story about my penny?
No.
Well, so you know that this last Veterans Day would have been Dad's 80th birthday.
Yep.
And it was not on Dad's birthday, but it was about 7 to 10 days after his birthday. I was out in my backyard and I was thinking about Dad, as I had been a lot, just in, you know, it kind of brought up a lot of, you know, not anything super intense or anything, but just kind of, you know, positive thoughts and curiosity and all the normal stuff, I guess. But I was standing out there just kind of, you know, enjoying my backyard and happened to be thinking about Dad. And I looked down at the ground, and as I think you might be aware, my backyard has occasionally unearthed bits of trash and archival junk from the soil. A lot of blue glass and a lot of like light bulb stubs and toothbrushes and just stuff that didn't decompose, you know, little bits of iron, little bits of iron that used to be a tool of some sort or whatever. But I had never found, never had a coin unearthed of any kind before, but I was standing on the stepping stone out there and looked down in the ground, and there was what was very obviously a penny-sized circular shape on the ground. You know, it jumped out at me because it was a perfectly round thing. I picked it up, and I could tell it was a penny by the size and weight, but it was so dirt encrusted that I couldn't see that it was a penny yet. But obviously I knew it was a penny, and I was like, huh. And immediately thought to myself, as you do when you pick up a penny, I wonder what year it is.
What's the date?
Yeah. And so I took it inside and put it under the sink and used my thumbnail to get enough of the gunk off of it to see the date. And the date on the penny is 1941.
Wow. I'm not sure whether you call that pennies from heaven or what.
I hadn't thought of that. That's a good one. But anyway, so I've since put it in a vinegar and salt solution to try to get it in. It's not shiny, but it is. You can tell it's a cleanish penny now. And I've got it sitting here next to my monitor for the time being. I'm going to do something more grand with it eventually. But
awesome. Try some lemon juice.
Lemon juice. Okay. That's a good idea. So
that was probably 100% copper penny.
It might be. It's whatever they call them, a wheat penny. Is that what's got the, you know, the kind of
the shaft of wheat on it? Yeah.
The backside of it is the shaft of wheat. I was pretty excited. So
that's awesome. That's a great story.
Thank you. I will say we should wrap things up there, and I'm glad we're back on the horse. I didn't mention it at the beginning, but we've been so busy the months of October and November that we had to put the podcast aside for a little while. It's nice to be back.
It is nice to be back.